Well, we welcome you back to this final episode of the Idaho Farm and Ranch Show. Well, ponds provide multiple fishing opportunities, whether those bodies of water are natural or man-made, used for aquaculture or recreation. Here's Rod Bain with more.
Whether it is a commercial freshwater fish operation or a body of water on property used for recreation, ponds offer opportunity to cast a line and spend time fishing. Chuck Sikra of University of Florida Extension adds,
ponds vary a lot, both in how they're built and what they're used for, but they can all provide tremendous fishing opportunities for people.
There are several kinds of both natural and man-made ponds, some you might be familiar with, perhaps even as a favorite fishing hole. For examples of natural ponds,
there could be really shallow, kind of weedy ponds, maybe housing northern pike, yellow perch, bass, bluegill. Up in Michigan, they had sinkhole ponds, which were formed by glaciers. They were really deep, often had trout in them, sometimes bass, bluegills. Down south, we have sinkhole ponds, where the ground collapses and we end up with a deep pond. Lots of shallow cypress ponds, beaver ponds, often support trout on small streams, maybe bass, bluegill.
Man-made ponds include
impoundments, where people maybe dam up a small watershed or a small stream, spring run, and it's nice because we can manipulate the water levels. And then there's a lot of dugout ponds where in Texas I worked on stock tanks where on the side of a hill they would dig out a pond, take the dirt, build a small levee, and then as water runs down the hill they have a pond used for watering livestock but also can provide some good fishing opportunities. A lot of places we have high water table right below the ground, so if you scoop out the dirt, your pond is sitting in that surficial water table. With that type of pond, you often don't have any way to control water levels.
Sikra points out that man-made ponds are primarily constructed for aquaculture purposes.
Those ponds are built so a seine could be pulled through and fish either partially harvested or totally harvested. So the advantage of man-made ponds is really towards the aquaculture fish production standpoint. Somebody wanting a few ponds to grow, say, some catfish or maybe up north, where generally trout are done more in raceways, flowing often concrete or long shallow ponds where the water flows down through from a spring.
A growing number of ponds are becoming part of agritourism operations.
In Florida, we have a lot of 20, 30, 40-acre, quote-unquote, ponds. People don't fish them a lot, so they may actually lease them to a small group of people, a family, just like people lease hunting lands for, say, deer hunting, quail hunting, and restrict who can have access to it. But we also have ponds that people will charge so many dollars per day, and the public can come in and drop money off. Often it's a mailbox, and go fish. They're limited how many fish they can keep. And then we have the more intensive, where people stock, say, catfish. Fish and people come in and they fish and they pay by the pound or they pay a certain amount per day and they get to keep a couple, three fish.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This past summer, fires affected the residents in northern Idaho near Bonner's Ferry. And today we learn what it takes for the men and women involved to combat and prevent different types of situations in this report from the Idaho Farm Bureau.
We, as the safety officers on this fire, we monitor each division's through the operations they'll be going through each day. So that evening we'll have a meeting with operations, with the divisions, with safeties, with there's a air attack base out there with helicopters, and we all get together and discuss our plans for the next day. And then the safety officer basically lists all the hazards that they can think of that they could face in those missions, and look at is it a mission that we need to be doing, and if so, how can we mitigate as many risks as possible to make it a safe mission? So, for instance, like I said, driving out here, this is just a smaller incident, but driving out here, we talked about the animals, so just making sure to mitigate that we let people know each day and remind people, because people are tired, they're working 16-hour days, just simple things like, hey, make sure you get your lights on, make sure you stick to the speed. It may seem a little slow, but there's been a lot of deer sightings, make sure you're right. Now make sure if there's buckets working in an area where we plan to do bucket drops, that heavy equipment isn't working, because they're dropping multi-swimming pools worth of water down to the ground, and even heavy equipment like a dozer's in there, or some individuals are in there plugging in hose or building line, that can be detrimental. If they're planning on going in and scouting or working in an area, making sure snags are mitigated before we get folks on the ground into that area. That's basically the primary mission, I would say.
So as a public information officer, my number one priority is keeping the public informed. I have information boards posted around the area that I update the maps and some facts daily on it, and we answer phone calls and emails, questions from the public about what's going on out here. We hold community meetings, so to get people together that maybe don't have access to internet or the conventional ways of learning information, and we have kind of question and answer sessions. We hold cooperator meetings, so all of the, the fire departments, the police department, the Forest Service representatives, a whole bunch of cooperators that are working with us, we have kind of information sessions with them also, so that we try to get as much information as possible. We're not trying to keep secrets.
So we're at the Coeur d'Alene Air Tanker Base, and at this base, we refill the air tankers with retardant after they drop. So an airplane will come into the ramp area here, we'll pull into the pit, and our personnel direct them where to park, and then we have personnel that come out and load the airplane with retardant, and it's like this plane behind us here will hold 3,000 gallons of retardant, and we can load them in 8 minutes or less, and then they're back out again to go and make another drop. So they have to come back here after every drop to get reloaded, and then we can also refuel them while they're here as well.
And the drops can be hundreds of miles away?
Yeah, these air tankers can respond anywhere in the country. They're a national resource. We're fortunate that we get to have them here when they are available.
We look at the fire behavior and how fast the fire is moving. We want to make sure that we have enough time to do whatever actions we're talking about. And in the case of the Kootenai River Complex, it was putting in dozer line and hand line along the public private lands boundaries. And in certain cases, we'll do our structure protection work, which could include putting, we'll have some blivets or portable water tanks that we run portable pumps off of, that we can have, a small sprinkler system around somebody's structure. Sometimes, if we've got a good, steady stream source, we might even put a sprinkler line in as our primary line and just wet the fuels down so the fire's not going to want to move through it. Do some a little bit of shaded fuel break right along the line, and that's some of what you see up there on the Kootenai River Complex. As we've gone around and we'll inventory all where all the homes are at, and then we'll order the equipment that's needed to put it in place, and then based on where the fire's at and how it's behaving, we'll decide, yep, it's time to put that equipment in place so we're ready if the fire chooses to move down in this area.
Well, many producers may see their profit margins squeezed a bit this year as commodity prices fall and input costs rise. Here's Gary Crawford with more.
A drop in farm cash receipts and net income. That is what USDA's analysts are projecting for this year. The latest forecast has producers generating just over $150.5 billion in net cash income.
Down about 21% relative to last year,
which was a record high income year. This from Spiro Stefano. He runs the USDA's Economic Research Service, and he says USDA is projecting a 4.3% decline in total cash receipts, a 3% drop for crops.
Corn, soybeans, cotton, fruit, vegetables, all forecast to go down.
Only wheat will see an increase in receipts, but by less than 1%. Livestock receipts, meanwhile, expected to drop by 5.7%, led by a decline in dairy sales. Also, farmers will get a lot less from the government. USDA says direct government payments will be down this year by about 34%. Meanwhile, on production expenses, last year those went up 11%. You may remember this year,
they're going to increase, but not as much, about 4%.
led by interest rate expenses up 22%. Much smaller increases for livestock and labor, possible small declines maybe for fertilizer, fuel, and feed. But in general, most producers are going to see profits drop from last year's record high by almost 21%. Ooh, but is this the right music for this story? One analyst says, no, this is not going to be a gloom and doom year. First off,
almost any year in connection to 2022 is going to look less favorable.
USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer told us we have to look at this new forecast not as a farm income disaster by any means.
Yes, it is declining relative to last year. Yes, receipts are falling. Yes, government payments are falling. Yes, input prices continue to rise, but it's still a better than the long run average farm income year.
Meyer says this is not a case of asking, is the cup half full or it's half empty?
The glass is three quarters full. It's still a quite good year for farm income.
He says producer margins may be squeezed, yes, and so
we're tightening the belt here a little bit. Still got plenty of room.
And Meyer says the farm sector will make it through this year.
Still in pretty good shape.
This is not in good shape. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Just ahead, our final segment with new developments in our country's challenge of Canada's dairy rate quotas. And of course, we'll bring you Paul Marchant's Irons in the Fire on the Idaho Farm and Ranch Show.
It may not require a textbook, but it's filled with valuable lessons. It may not take place in a classroom, but it's an ideal environment for learning. It may not involve a diploma, but it can help prepare Idaho's young people for life. It's high school sports. High school sports can play a critical role in a student's overall education. In fact, studies show that students that participate in high school sports are more likely to enjoy greater levels of achievement in their academic lives. If you think high school sports are only about competition, think again. Better yet, think about attending a high school sporting event in your community. You'll be amazed by what you see. High school sports, a winning part of a complete education. This message presented by the Idaho High School Activities Association and the Idaho Athletic Administrators Association,